My guest on today's KHSU Magazine is Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy, writer, blogger, and educator. Dr. Risling-Baldy is Hoopa, Yurok, and Karuk, and an enrolled member of the Hoopa Valley Tribe in Northern California. She's a professor of Native American Studies at Humboldt State University and has authored her first book, We Are Dancing for You, Native Feminisms and the Revitalization of Women's Coming-of-Age Ceremonies. Welcome, Kutcha.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Can you define for me what Native feminisms are?
You know, I think the work that's been done for a number of years to talk about feminism and the importance of equality for all genders really has left out a conversation about how gender equality and the way that we understand gender has always been a conversation that has happened in Native communities. And the goals of Native feminisms are to sort of highlight that Native peoples come from like a very long tradition of Native feminism, that they value the equality of all genders, that they were having conversations about the importance of equality in their cultures and societies, and that colonialism really targeted those types of practices for eradication. And so Native feminisms is sort of saying we can't have a conversation about feminism without having a conversation about the impact of colonialism, and that the goals of what feminism needs to be working toward need to help support the ongoing sovereignty and self-determination of Native nations. There's all kinds of examples of Native nations throughout the Americas where they would bring women to treaty negotiations. They would bring women and they would refuse to talk to the women. And you have lots of indigenous nations that had women's councils, or they had women who were the ultimate decision makers about if the nation was going to go to war, if they were going to make a treaty. And those kinds of practices were really targeted by colonialism because they did not want women to be in charge. It affects everything. It affects the role that Native women have in their own cultures, like in a contemporary time period. It affects the sort of statistics that you see today with violence against Native women. You can see a direct link between the way that they viewed Native women during sort of like the missions and the gold rush and this whole period of time where they're trying to sort of like get rid of Native people and they're trying to genocide and annihilate them. Native women are in very particular types of incidences. They're not just viewed as wanting them to just all disappear or be dead. Most of them actually get sold into slavery. And so you're looking at the records and you see that there's a large slavery institution that comes up in California during the gold rush. And most of the time when you look at headlines, it'll say something like all the men were killed and the women and children were taken. And they don't really elaborate on what taken is. But really what that means is most of the time for women, that meant that they were sold to someone as a concubine, as a slave. They were sold to prostitution rings. And so it was really like women are treated in this way. And that's not to say men are treated better just because most of the time that just meant that they were killed. Like the men are the threats to them. And when you look at the actual records in Humboldt County, which is really interesting, because sometimes when people think about the slave trade, they'll think that, you know, people are going in and mostly getting adults because they need workers. If you look at the records in Humboldt County, it's actually mostly children, ages like 7 to 12, and it's mostly young girls who are being traded into slavery. And that's not something that a lot of people think about, that when we're talking about this system of slavery, I mean, it's really pretty obvious that what we're talking about is like a system of sex slavery. And so it becomes dangerous for us as Native people to elevate and celebrate our women the way that we had. Because if we take women as leaders, they will kidnap those women. If we take women to the table to have discussions, they will go after those women. And then we have this dance, this ceremony that we do for young women when they come of age, which is usually when they start menstruating. And it becomes dangerous to do that dance because people would know that we were celebrating this girl and they would show up, minors would show up to kidnap that girl or to take that girl. Really? Because they're in a vulnerable position of being in ceremony, not in a space where they can sort of like, you know, be defended. And there's plenty of old stories about minors spreading rumors that what we were doing in this dance is advertising that the girl was a woman so she could go off and be taken. And so they would show up and say, see, this is what you guys are doing. You're like advertising her. So they totally misconstrued what was going on so that they could justify these actions. And so when, after a long time of, I mean, after a period of time of that, we as a people had to make a decision about what we were going to do, because our young girls are really vulnerable. And the dance kind of goes underground. You don't see it as much. You don't hear about it. You have a lot of people that won't do it. But in reality, we were faced with these very tough decisions about what it would mean to put our girls out there and the way that people were using that as to be able to target them.
I didn't know that, Kucha. I mean, I'm not surprised, but it's still shocking and horrific. The coming of age ceremonies have come back into regular practice in the last 30, 40 years or so. Can you talk about how the decision came about to have a revitalization of these practices and start celebrating a young woman's coming of age?
What I realized is that while I had this idea from the anthropological records that this dance had like gone extinct, that there was a period of time where we didn't do it, they're actually really... It was always a part of like the imagination, the cultural imagination of our elders. And they wouldn't let us forget. When they would do demonstrations at the high school, they would do a demonstration of the ceremony. Even though we weren't really doing it, they were like, you have to know about this. When they named our ceremonies, so when ethnographers came into the area and they were like, let's talk about your ceremonies, every single one of them was like, this is one of our ceremonies. Whether or not we were doing it currently, this is one of our ceremonies. I think that the impetus for it was a lot of women who were saying, we need to do this. A lot of elders who kept bringing it up. Everybody that I talked to, they each had a story about one of their great uncles or great grandfathers or grandmothers or aunties who was like, by the way, somebody needs to do this.
Mm. And so men were encouraging the practice of the flower dance.
Oh, yeah.
Ceremony.
All kinds of like elder men saw, like, know the value of it. It's actually a dance that men are very involved in. They sing, they dance, they are a part of it. It's very important for the young woman to see men as a part of it because these are men that are going to be a part of her life.
The cover of your book is really beautiful.
The cover is actually based off a photo of I took of a young woman. She's wearing the blue jay veil, which is what the young woman wears when she's in the ceremony. And there are blue jay veils throughout different tribes here in the Northwest that they use during women's ceremonies. And in Hoopa, what they talk about is it helps the girl to remain in meditation because she has to, in different periods of time, run through the valley. And people can see her while she's running. And so it shields her from the people that are looking at her. It reminds her to stay in a certain space. It also helps to let people know that she's in this period of time with her ceremony. So if they can like not look directly at her or turn away, because that helps her to remain in meditation. What the girls talked about with me, because I actually interviewed a lot of them to talk about what was going on, and they really said that it was a reminder for them to think about their next step and not to just be looking way forward or way back, or to think about how much further they had to go, because they have to run every single day of the ceremony. And they said, you know, instead of looking all the way down the path, like, I have so much further to go and how am I going to make it? The veil makes me look right here in the right now. Wow. And I can only see what's right in front of me. And so then I can keep going until I get to the point that I need to get to. So I think it teaches them a lot about the decision-making process. Like what the old ones, they said that the old ones said, like, how she runs is how she's going to live her life. And so you help her to be able to live her life in a good way. And she gets to make these decisions. If she trips, they tell her she should go back and run that same part again. If she gets tired, she can slow down. If she wants to go faster. But this is about her saying, who do I want to be? And I have the strength and the fortitude to be able to make these decisions for myself. So all those kinds of things are happening in this ceremony for her.
That's a really powerful experience.
I think so. It's funny how many of the young women were like, I was kind of afraid of the run. But then when they did it, they were like, it was a really amazing experience. And it allowed me to see that I could do it. That I could do anything. And they all talk about how they took that with them. It was like, well, you know, I need to do this next thing. Well, I know I can do it because I did these other things.
I think we could all benefit from something like that for sure.
It's so simple. All you have to do is sit with somebody and tell them stories about puberty and adolescence. Like, yeah. Positive stories. And then that's it. That's all. And even if they act like they're not listening to you, they say that that makes all the difference. Like, that's all you have to do.
Well, and but you have to reframe your own personal stories about puberty and adolescence in a positive way, too, right?
Oh, it's true. I mean, like, well, see, here's the thing. So a lot of the reason why I did this research myself, I always say, like, research finds you. And it says, like, this is what you're going to do now. And so what happened was, like, I started my period when I was 12. And my mom.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, my mom, she was like, we're going to go out to dinner. We're going to celebrate. And I was, of course, why would we celebrate, right? I didn't understand. But we went out to the Eureka Inn because that was a fancy restaurant. The waiter came over. His name was Gary. And the reason I know that his name was Gary is because he said, my name is Gary. Are we celebrating anything today? And I looked at my mom like,
please don't.
Please. Like, I was like, don't you dare. And she said, no, we're just like a mother and a daughter out for dinner. And after he left, she said to me, and I was 12 years old, she said, you know, we used to do a dance for girls when they started menstruating. And it was a time of great celebration. And we haven't done this dance in a really long time. But if you wanted me to, I would figure out some way to do it. I would find some way to make it happen. And I didn't know. I didn't know all the reasons why we weren't doing it. I didn't know about colonization. I didn't know about, like, the violence that it took to stop us from doing this dance. I didn't know any of that. All I knew was that she wanted me to, like, in my mind, get up in front of a group of people and, like, announce that I was menstruating. And so I was like, no, I would never do that. That's disgusting. That's so gross. And she let it go. And then for like a number of years after that, she along with other people would have these conversations with each other about what it would mean to bring this dance back. She told her own story to me about how when she started her period, the school told her she was sick and sent her home, but didn't tell her what she was sick with. So in her mind, she's like dying. Like,
well, yes, you're bleeding.
Yeah. So they're like, you're sick. Go home. But when she got
really
home,
serious.
Her grandfather was there and she was like, you know, I'm sick. So I had to come home. And he was like, you're not sick. Like, you're a woman. This is amazing. And she said he was a guy who wasn't even like a big, he wasn't really into celebrating culture at that time, that she had never thought of him that way. But immediately he was like, this is a big deal. And he said that he did. He said to her, he made her sit in a chair and he was like, I don't have a song because we would sing for you. But I don't have a flower dance song, but I have this one song. And he sang to her this song that my whole family sings to babies when they try to put them to sleep. And we call it the Hey Nunny song. And then he made her brothers go to the store and buy her tampons because in his mind, he needed to find some way that they could give her something,
wow,
like a gift to be involved.
Oh my
so
gosh.
She was like, all that happened. And at the time, I didn't really get what he was doing. I'd never seen one. But in his mind, this is what we do. And he needed to give me that experience of being positive about what was happening to me. And so all the women I talked to, they start talking to each other. Like, they all had moments where somebody said to them, no, this is what it's going to be. And then she had said to me and I had said no. So she worked for a number of years after that with different people in our area on bringing this dance back. And they decided that they were going to do it for the first young woman who had agreed to do it, whose name at the time was Kayla Carpenter. Now she's Kayla Begay. And so they were putting that dance together. And I was living in San Diego at the time. I was in my 20s. And I was actually in a very violent relationship. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't talking to anybody about it. I didn't tell anybody what was going on. And I always tell people, like, I don't, when I think back to my life then, I don't recognize myself in that space. I sort of really, like, if anybody's going through it, like, I lost myself in that relationship. And I couldn't admit what was happening. And one night after a very sort of like loud and dangerous kind of like fight, I was on the bathroom floor. So he like left me there, and I picked up the phone and I called my mom and I said, "Mom, I'm going to leave him." And she said, "You are making the right decision." And I said, "No, Mom, he's right. I'm nothing. And I'll be nothing without him." And she like paused for this really long time on the phone, and I'll never forget it. She said, "Kacha, we should have danced for you." And it was for her, she said, at that time, like this clicking moment of what it would have meant for me not to be able to walk into the world and ever think that I was nothing, that I was nobody, that nobody could tell me that, that I had to go into the world knowing who I was so that when somebody would come in and try to tell me that I was nobody, I would be like, that's not a thing. That doesn't exist. And here I was all by myself. And that's where I was at. I just couldn't, I felt like nothing. And so I remember I was sitting there and I thought, well, I have to get up the bathroom floor. And I didn't know how I was going to get up. I didn't know how I was going to leave. So I remembered my grandma said to me, like, if you don't know what to do, like sing a song and then you'll just be able to do what you're supposed to do. And I didn't have a song, but I did have songs that I had heard other people sing. And so I started to sing those songs and I got up and I like packed a bag and I was leaving. And I don't like people to think that it was that simple, because I always say to people, I've done a lot of work with domestic violence and a lot of domestic violence survivors. It's never easy. You go back. I went back, like, you know, all these other things had to happen, but I'll never forget that moment, because that's what I went back to a lot when I was thinking about how I was finally going to get out of this relationship, was that moment of my mom saying to me, like you were somebody, like we should have danced for you to show you who you are. And I think that in that moment, my wanting to tell that story, like to tell this story of this dance and why it's so important, came out of wanting other people, other girls, to be able to see why it's so important and to be able to talk about it and for those words to be our words. And I know that it's helpful. I know that all the young women who we have done this dance for are amazing and in all different kinds of ways. And Kayla, who I mentioned is the first flower dance girl, is now a professor here at Humboldt State.
Right, right.
All the girls, like, you know, we have one who's a really fantastic like educator, one who's finishing law school, one who is like at UC Davis studying to be a vet. Like, I mean, just all of them are so powerful in so many ways. And I think that even us as the women of that community who have come in and sang and danced, we have become more powerful because of it. And the men who have come to sing and dance have become more powerful because of it. So our whole community has been able to remember that the empowerment of women empowers the entire community. And that's, I think, really important.
Thank you so much for that story and for sharing. Is there anything you want to make sure that we say in this interview?
So there's a couple things. First is, I got word from Northtown Books that the book should be at Northtown. So I'm the executive director of a nonprofit called the Native Women's Collective. We designed a project where we are going to be giving books to every American Indian Youth Center, Native Rehabilitation Program, Youth and Adult Correctional Facility, and Tribal Library in California. And people can go to the Native Women's Collective site and they can click on the book project and donate copies of the book.
And that book is We Are Dancing for You, Native Feminisms and the Revitalization of Women's Coming of Age Ceremonies, written by Dr. Kacha Risling Baldy. Thank you so much for the conversation, Kacha, and I look forward to having you back for future conversations, and best of luck with your book.
Thank you.